from West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for the legislature today is provided by the following.
West Virginia University, online at wvu.edu. AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Online at aarp.org/wv. The West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working to double the degrees produced annually in our state by 2025. Through increased opportunities for West Virginians to earn the credentials today's economy demands. The High Technology Foundation, building a stronger West Virginia, online at wvhtf.org.
At the legislature today, in the second year of Republican control at the statehouse, lawmakers have voted a second and third times to override Tomlin vetoes. Common Core and funding for a specialized school take the spotlight in the House, and Agriculture Commissioner Walt Helmick joins us with an update on the state's deer farming program. Those stories and more coming up on the legislature today. Good evening, I'm Ashton Mara. Today, lawmakers in both chambers voted to override the vetoes Governor Tomlin handed down yesterday. In his message to disapprove a right-to-work law, Tomlin disputed its need, saying no company had ever cited the lack of a right-to-work measure as a reason not to locate in West Virginia. As for the prevailing wage repeal, Tomlin said in his veto message he believed the recalculation approved by lawmakers during the 2015 session hadn't been in place long enough to work. A majority of both the House and Senate, however, disagreed with the governor, and the two provisions will soon become law.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In the House, there was little discussion as delegates considered the governor's veto of both the prevailing wage repeal and right-to-work measures. Only Delegate Mike Caputo stood to address his fellow members. Caputo is an international district vice president for the United Mine Workers of America, as well as a representative of Marion County.
I just want to take a moment to thank the governor for trying his best to veto what I believe are two bills that clearly the majority of West Virginians that we represent don't believe we need.
The House voted 54-43 to override the veto of the West Virginia Workplace Freedom Act, or Right to Work, and 54-44 to override the prevailing wage repeal veto. In the Senate, members of the minority party were much more vocal about their support of the governor's vetoes, including Senator Bill Laird, who spoke before the vote on the Right to Work measure.
Clearly, this issue has fractured the body of our Senate, and we sit here today as a House divided. If this issue was of sufficient weight and value to hold any potential whatsoever to bolster the economic conditions of our state and increase prosperity for our people, then and only then could the consideration of this divisive issue be considered to have been worth it.
Other Democrats expressed their disapproval of both the right-to-work bill and prevailing wage repeal, but Senator Robert Carnes, a Republican from Upshur County, explained his support.
As an adult, I have myself been forced to work outside the state of West Virginia most of my adulthood. And as most of you know, if not all of the members of this chamber, I'm a father of 8 children. And several years ago, I realized that if I did not want for my children to have to work outside of the state of West Virginia, move outside of the state of West Virginia like so many of our children have, grandchildren and beyond, that real and consequential change must come to West Virginia. And that started me on the path that has brought me here. And it's only with the idea of improving not just my children's future, but the children of West Virginia across the state to improve their future. It's only with that idea that I originally supported this.
Senators voted along party lines, 18-16, to override the vetoes of both bills. Both will take effect in May. After the vote, Senate President Bill Cole says he was relieved to have the issues behind him so his chamber can focus on moving the state forward in other ways.
I genuinely believe that these are things that will help move our state forward. We know that we have to do something different if we in fact want those different results. And my goodness, it's time for different results.
In statements released Thursday, Senate President Cole and House Speaker Tim Armstead both said they were disappointed but not surprised by the vetoes. Cole said he doesn't foresee many override votes in the remainder of the session.
We haven't looked at it. I mean, certainly the ones that might get a veto or not, we tend to try and run them earlier in the session so we're in session and can override the veto. But these obviously were the two most contentious issues, so hopefully not.
Senators will begin working on the controversial bill to change permitting requirements to carry a concealed weapon in the state on Monday. Tomlin vetoed a similar bill last year, but with some changes made in the House, like bumping the minimum age to carry without a permit from 18 to 21, Cole says he believes the bill is a compromise that could get a signature.
After 2 days of meetings, members of the House are taking a step back from a bill to repeal Common Core-based education standards and the aligned tests in the state. The House Education Committee heard from many for and against the measure over the past few days, even though the State Board of Education voted to repeal and replace the standards in December. Beth Voorhees has this update.
The House Education Committee, for the second year in a row, is focused on repealing Common Core-based education standards in West Virginia. In meetings this week, they heard from curriculum specialists, the state superintendent, and others on how the repeal would impact West Virginia's education system. House Education Chair Paul Espinoza says now the committee is taking a step back from the bill. He wants his members to digest the information presented before they move on to possible changes and a vote.
If I could point to, one aspect of this legislation that I think there's widespread support on, it's the whole question of our assessments here in West Virginia. The length of time that's dedicated to the assessments, and also the type of assessments that we're using.
Espinoza says his members are also concerned with the time frame of the repeal as set out in the bill. West Virginia Superintendent of Schools, Dr. Michael Martirano, says a quick repeal would be costly, both in terms of dollars and in terms of the progress of the state's education system. For the legislature today, I'm Beth Voorhees.
The House has progressed on other education-related issues, though, including a bill to aid the state's struggling schools for the deaf and blind. Liz McCormick reports.
House Bill 4147 would make the West Virginia Schools for the Deaf and Blind eligible for funding from the West Virginia School Building Authority, or SBA. The SBA awards some $50 million in additional funds each year to county school systems for building or renovation projects. The Schools for the Deaf and Blind are located in the small town of Romney in the Eastern Panhandle. It's a school that serves pre-K to 12th graders from all around the state. But over the years, the campus and its buildings have fallen into disrepair. Michael Green is the State Board of Education president.
The West Virginia School for the Deaf and Blind is under the control of the West Virginia Board of Education. The background of that is that it is not in any particular county, so therefore it is directly responsible to the state school board.
Green explains because the schools for the deaf and blind are controlled at the state level, they don't have the ability to raise their own funds through bonds or levies like a regular county school system. That's led to problems with facilities upkeep, building security, and the installment of specialized equipment. So last year, the schools reached out to the legislature for help. In a near unanimous vote, lawmakers approved an appropriations bill giving the schools an additional $1.5 million for construction and improvement projects. Governor Tomlin vetoed that measure, though, citing larger problems with the facility. House Education Chairman Paul Espinoza of Jefferson County says an assessment of the schools conducted after Tomlin's 2015 veto was successful.
That study was commissioned by the governor. He directed the state board to conduct a study. And again, it pretty clearly indicated that there were significant needs.
The newly approved bill is a new attempt to meet those needs by allowing the schools to ask for SBA funding. It passed overwhelmingly 98-0 in the House Friday.
I know a number of members of the House and Senate Education Committees during the interims did visit the Romney Schools for the Deaf and Blind, and we're able to see firsthand some of the challenges that they have. So this legislation simply would make it possible for the Schools for the Deaf and Blind to compete for SBA funding just as other counties do.
The schools had asked the SBA for those funds in the past, but did not award any dollars because board members didn't believe they were able to under state code. Espinosa says he's optimistic that both the Senate and Governor Tomlin will approve of this bill and the schools will be able to get the funding they need. For the Legislature Today, I'm Liz McCormick in the House.
Bill Laird represents the state's 10th senatorial district. A Democrat, he's from Fayette County. Senator Laird was elected to the Senate in 2008. He previously served in the state House of Delegates from 1996 through 1998 and twice served as the sheriff of Fayette County for a total of 14 years. Roger Henshaw is a Republican from Clay County. He was elected to the House of Delegates in 2014 to represent the state's 33rd House District. He serves as a parliamentarian for the Republican National Committee and is the only one in the state. Brent Boggs was elected to the House of Delegates in 1996. He represents the 34th House District from Braxton County. A Democrat, Boggs serves as the minority chair of the House Finance Committee, a committee he briefly chaired as a member of the majority party in 2014.
It took several proposals and years of work, but deer farming is now legal in the state of West Virginia. The bill took effect in July, and some 8 months later, West Virginians are now getting a taste of the locally produced product. Joining us to discuss this program and others he's overseeing is a former lawmaker, now the state's Agriculture Commissioner, Walt Helmick. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for the invitation. I certainly appreciate it. Look forward each year to discussing different issues, and now, of course, it's agriculture for the last 2 or 3 years, so it works out very well.
Well,
appreciate
we're it. So happy to have you. But let's start with this deer farming program. It's been, you know, almost a year now since the bill was passed in the House and in the Senate. What's going on with the program? How has it progressed?
Well, we've moved forward with it. We've had oversight of it for the last 6 months to 7 months, and we now have, as many people know, we have it on the menus in some restaurants in West Virginia. So we've moved forward. We're looking to restructure the program some. Obviously, we want to advance deer farming in West Virginia, but we're taking the necessary steps to make sure that we're in step with the Department of Natural Resources and their whitetail program and in step with other farming issues in West Virginia. But we do want to advance deer farming in West Virginia. We think we can create a significant amount of jobs over time with it. So we did one step, and that was to get West Virginia deer on the menu in West Virginia.
Well, for a little bit of background, this bill had been proposed for several years, and there was a lot of conflict with the Division of Natural Resources. They weren't really backing this program. So how is that relationship working with them?
Oh, it works very well. We in fact, from time to time, if there's an issue, a perceived issue, we talk with the Department of Natural Resources, and we followed up in the transition from natural resources to agriculture. Worked very well with them, and there hasn't been a problem.
Well, that's great to hear. So earlier this week, we did a story about the Cedar Lakes Conference Center, which is located in Jackson County. And after a state board of education audit a few years ago, it was recommended that they get rid of Cedar Lakes. They've been trying to figure out how to do that for the past couple years. And this year, the proposal says, give Cedar Lakes to the Department of Agriculture. How do you feel about that transition?
We feel very good about it. We think that that we're probably the right fit. We think as time goes on and we have a little bit of time to prove ourselves that it will be the right fit. Now, we've not been out there pursuing the ownership of Cedar Lakes. That's not at all the case. However, we look at Cedar Lakes as a footprint for agriculture because it initially was developed as an FFA camp and an FHA camp, Future Farmers, Future Homemakers of America. We see it as a footprint for agriculture in West Virginia, and as we'd move forward with our programs in the state and that our aggregation points and whatever that we're putting together and the development of agriculture, we need a facility to where we can take the next generation, the 4-H'ers and those other groups, bring them into our program, and we think that Cedar Lakes is the appropriate place to do that.
So describe for us what that would look like. If the Department of Agriculture would take over Cedar Lakes, what kinds of things do you anticipate doing there?
Well, they have a good foundation board at Cedar Lakes, and so the foundation board, as we see it, would stay in place, and nothing would really change there. They'll do the commercial part of it, the renting of the rooms and that sort of thing, and then we'll dovetail in with our program that will allow people, let's say, for instance, from Wheeling, from Martinsburg, or from southern West Virginia, that we feel that is right, and the FFA programs in West Virginia, to bring them to Cedar Lakes, introduce them to what we are now doing, and the new movement in agriculture in the state. And that new movement, of course, is to consolidate several counties into one area, which we call aggregation points. And in order to do that, we have to have a situation, we have to have a setup, for instance, that will allow us to go from the growers to the aggregation centers. And there's going to have to be some education involved in that. And in doing so, we think we can get to that level.
Well, you've mentioned it a couple times now, these aggregation centers. What does that mean? What would those do?
Well, we're putting together, actually there's going to be about 10 of them in the state, and the first one that'll be fully in operation will be down at Huntington, and it'll include Jackson County, Mason County, Putnam, Lincoln, Wayne, and Cabell, with the center being in Huntington. And there we will bring product grown from those counties into the center and prepare it and go through the necessary steps to make sure that we're doing it legally and that we're doing it in a manner that will allow us then to go to the distributors, which would be West Virginia distributors, of course, and have it on the shelves of stores in West Virginia. West Virginia growing product, obviously growing on West Virginia land by West Virginians, we think there's a significant future in it, but we have to dovetail into Cedar Lakes and to the education system as well.
So this is a way to give West Virginians access to those locally produced products.
Absolutely. We have to, right now, we are consuming $7,300,000,000 worth of food in West Virginia. Now, we grow less than one, significantly less than one, so there's a $6 billion either opportunity or problem. We don't see it as a problem. We see it as an opportunity. But we have to educate the folks because we're transforming into a different culture. And we think we can get there, but we have to go through these steps. We've studied it. We've got some good people working with us. And we think the aggregation points will allow us to get there, whether it's in Martinsburg, Huntington, or here in Charleston. One of the aggregation points will be here. We're looking near Charleston for that point. We're talking and dealing with some people. And we think we can do it in a way that will allow West Virginians to grow a product here that we'll be able to put on the plates in West Virginia.
Well, Commissioner, in about the minute or so that we have left, every agency in the state is having to deal with budget cuts from the previous years, this year, and are expected to see those next year as well. How is the Department of Agriculture holding up with those cuts?
We realize that the state is not in good financial shape, and so the last couple of years, it has been difficult and very difficult at times to deal with it. But at the end of the day, we see a number of our employees reaching that age of 35 years of service in that range. And so when they get ready to retire and do retire, when they announce it to us, we consolidate that position into another. So we have a significant number, in the way we see it, 20-some people less than we had 3 years ago. So we're looking at each individual, trying to consolidate some positions, and then taking the money that we generate from the farms and building the aggregation points. So we've been able to do it. We've worked with the legislative bodies, and of course a lot of them's my old-time friends. Works very well. The governor has been very supportive of what we're doing, but we are seeing a situation where we can't cut much more.
Of course. Agriculture Commissioner Walt Helmick, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for the invitation. I appreciate it.
If you've followed West Virginia politics over the years, two names are probably familiar to you, Republican Tom Potter and Democrat Chuck Chambers. Both served in the West Virginia House of Delegates and both faced many of the same challenges confronting the legislature today. In this feature produced by Russ Barber, Suzanne Higgins brings us this tale of two lawmakers.
After graduating from WVU Law School, Tom Potter served in the U.S. Air Force from 1957 to 1960 as a legal and claims officer, influenced by a visit to Charleston in his youth.
The reason I became a lawyer was because as a high school student in Montgomery High School up the river, I had come down here one day and visited the legislature. Thereafter, visited a courtroom and attended a trial. All of that led me to determine that I wanted to be a lawyer.
Potter moved to Charleston and began practicing law in 1960. 4 years later, the young Republican ran unsuccessfully for a seat in the House of Delegates.
I came to town without knowing very many people, and I sensed that if I was to be a successful lawyer, which was my ultimate goal, I would need to know more people and to have a bigger presence in the community.
Like Potter, Chuck Chambers, now Chief Judge of the United States District Court, Southern District of West Virginia, also earned his law degree at WVU. That was in 1978, the same year the Huntington Democrat made his first bid for public office. His reason for running, like Potter, to expand his client base.
I was a young lawyer, just started practicing law here in Huntington with my dad, and one afternoon I walked into my office, and a fellow lawyer was sitting there talking to my dad and was convincing my father that I should run for the House of Delegates as a way to get my name out and get known as a lawyer. So that's what got me started.
Tom Potter ran again for the House in 1966 and won, entering the chamber as a member in 1967 when the number of Republicans grew from 9 to 36.
As a result, the dynamics of the House changed with that many Republicans, and many of us were young lawyers and people with some business experience that had a different view of West Virginia and of what we needed to do to solve its problems than they were used to. Then, as now, we trailed the nation in nearly every category that was important to be high in, and we were low in those where we should have been high, and we were high in those where we should have been low. So we had more or less the same agenda as today. Not quite as extreme, perhaps, in some areas, but a pro-business, pro-development attitude.
Potter served 8 years in the legislature and chaired the West Virginia Republican Party from 1968 to 1976. While the number of Republicans in the House fluctuated over the years, the party was never able to take a majority of the chamber during Potter's career. Still, he says he and his fellow delegates at the time, no matter their political affiliation, were committed to the state and its people.
I had as many friends on the Democratic side as I did the Republican side, and it was a good place to be. And we felt that we could accomplish something good.
Chuck Chambers served as Speaker of the House for 10 years, beginning in 1987, 8 years after he was elected to the body. He says much like today, it was a time of significant economic downturn for the state.
We watched an exodus of jobs in our state. We had fiscal crisis after fiscal crisis. It was a really tough time, and we started to balance our books, started focusing on making sure that we had the money to cover our obligations and to fund our programs honestly and completely and to start investing in what we needed to invest in to help the state grow.
Chambers left the West Virginia House of Delegates in 1996 after serving 18 years and was appointed to the court in 1997. He says whether people see him as a career politician or a career public servant, he believes they're one and the same.
Very few people come into this not committed at some level to public service. That's why people do it. And certainly because of the political environment that you have to go through, there's a little bit of politician in the best public servant, but I think that that's good. I don't see those things as contradictory at all. There's nothing bad or evil about politics. People make it messy and people make it distasteful at times, but for the vast majority of folks, being politicians and being in public service are the same thing.
Chambers' advice for budding West Virginia politicians: begin in the legislature, where he says every day is a learning experience.
Serving in the legislature is a great education process. It teaches you a lot about what's going on in the state. It teaches you a lot about how the political process and government really do work. And those are skills that everybody needs if you're going to move up in office.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Suzanne Higgins.
On Monday, we focus on a bill approved by the House this week that's now making its way to the Senate, a discussion focused on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. This has been the Legislature Today. I'm Ashton Mara. We'll see you back here next week.
Support for the Legislature Today is provided by the following:
West Virginia University, online at wvu.edu. AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State, online at aarp.org/wv. The West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working to double the degrees produced annually in our state by 2025. Through increased opportunities for West Virginians to earn the credentials today's economy demands. The High Technology Foundation, building a stronger West Virginia, online at wvhtf.org. From West Virginia Public Broadcasting.